Good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. We are still on Syria. Last week, our guest Harold Rode made what I think is a point we need to focus on this week, and maybe we're going to focus on it for the foreseeable future. Where the U.S. and the West tend to prioritize democratic elections and individual rights, that is not the priority in the Middle East. Middle Eastern societies are more group-oriented and have a clan-based logic, according to Harold, and I think he's right. And he showed us examples of this with the unintended consequences of elections in Gaza, which brought you Hamas, and Jimmy Carter's sort of misplaced idealism regarding the Shah. This is just something to tuck in your head because it is. So we're going to talk about Syria today, and we're going to talk about the Druze and the horrific massacre of Druze people in Syria. We're going to talk about Israel's intervention to protect the Druze and the American response, which has not been, sadly, to prioritize the safety and security of the Druze people. Our guest today is Hussein Abdul Hussein of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He is the best person, I think, to tell us what is happening, why it's happening, and whether, perhaps, maybe, possibly, Syria can be moved to a sustainable political and social track. But before we go to Hussein, your JPC commercial. The Jewish Policy Center was established in 1985 as a nonprofit organization providing analysis of foreign and domestic policies. We support a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. Most important these days, and since October 7th, 2023, we support the legitimacy and security of Israel over anyone who would deny them. And now more than ever, we support the government of Israel and the IDF in its defense of the people inside of Israel and beyond its borders, and its defense of its friends, sometimes beyond its borders. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, we advocate for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. You can find us on our website, jewishpolicycenter.org. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. You can see our insight articles and our magazine, In Focus Quarterly. The summer issue is up. It is about shared threats and shared responses. I hope you find it interesting. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. And now our guest. Hussein Abdul Hussein is a research fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He focuses, actually, on the Gulf region and Yemen, including on Gulf relations with Iran and the Gulf peace process with Israel. But he was born and raised in Beirut, Baghdad, and Baalbek, three places that are very important and very interesting and about which he knows quite a bit. They are at the center, in fact, of major Middle East events. Hussein earned a degree in history and archaeology from the American University of Beirut. He worked as a reporter, later managing editor at Beirut's The Daily Star, and he reported from war zones on the Lebanese border with Israel and from Iraq. In Washington, he set up and managed the Arabic satellite network, Al Hora Iraq, after which he headed the Washington Bureau of the Kuwaiti Al Rai. He's been a visiting fellow at London's Chatham House, and he's published in English in the New York Times and the Washington Post. There's not all that much stuff I think you should read in the New York Times and the Washington Post, but yes, read Hussein Abdul Hussein when he is there. He's also widely read in Arabic, and he is appearing on media everywhere you think he should. So Hussein and I met on Twitter when it was Twitter, which is kind of like meeting on a dating app. You don't really know who you're talking to. People have the opportunity to do whatever they want, say whatever they want. But we have gotten to know each other. I have come to respect him enormously. And he's written for In Focus magazine. You should look up his article that was called Why There Is No Palestinian State. It's a great read. And it was long before October 7th, 2023. So I am really pleased to bring Hussein Abdul Hussein to you, to our listeners, because I want to learn something too. Hussein, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Shoshana. Thank you very much. Great introduction. Thanks to JPC for having me on. The Middle East is really something. And every week there's something unfolding. Every week when you think things are receding, just off of the after the end or the ceasefire between Israel and Iran, and then we get the events in Syria. Anyway, now today our focus will be the Druze. The Druze is a sect. They call themselves Islamic. They don't perceive of themselves as being really Islamic. There are only 2 million Jews who live around the world. The biggest block of them, 700,000, lives in Syria, mostly South Syria, but also in the north in Aleppo and in Idlib. There's also a significant number of them, 300,000 or so, in Lebanon, and 200 or 300,000 in Israel, and the rest are just scattered across the globe. Now, one thing to know about the Druze is that the Druze do not the average Druze does not practice their religion. It's only for people who are above 40 and who are enunciated into religion, who study, and so it's not open for the public. One of the reasons they did that is that they were scared that if the public, mainly the Muslims, learn about what these people say, they probably hurt them or come after them. So the Druze have perfected the way of living under the radar. And if you look up their towns and villages, they are rarely on main highways or main roads connecting big cities. They live mainly in rugged mountains, remote villages, keep to themselves. Now, even though they do not practice religion, there are two things that the Druze do all the time. They never leave their land. They defend their land, and they teach everyone who's in the Druze religion to defend when need be, when aliens or invaders show up. And number two, they marry Druze. And of course, the whole thing is set up in such a way that they have to stay closed in to be able to defend themselves against the others. Now, this said, this group of people is very peaceful, and they have never fought any war outside of their towns or villages or territories. They only fight when you show up, when you come to their villages. And that's why what you saw unfold in Syria over the past week was definitely not them starting the fight, was definitely not them assaulting others. It was definitely them trying to keep others from wiping them out, basically. One more thing I'd want to say about the Druze is that even though they have this cross-national connection, so the Druze of Syria and Lebanon and Israel and the rest of the world, they're really connected, they really care for one another, and they're really intermarried. However, each one of these Druze blocs are very loyal citizens to their states. So whether in Lebanon or in Syria or in Israel, they pledge allegiance to the government. In the case of Israel, Druze join the Israeli army. They fight in the army shoulder to shoulder with Jews and Arabs and other components of the Israeli population. And that's who they are. What happened in Syria was that the government of Damascus, for some reason, the new government of Damascus does not understand the configuration of how to deal with the Druze. Now, let's go back to the Assad family, the Assad dynasty that ruled, that governed Syria before this bunch of Islamists took over in December. The elder Assad, Papa Assad, was a savvy politician and also brutal dictator, but he understood when he had to just use his iron fist, and when he had to give space to small communities. And he did that for the Druze. So he understood that the Druze would pledge allegiance to him, that the Druze would stay out of politics, which is great for someone like Assad. But he also understood that the Druze do not like people going around their villages and intervening in their social affairs and other kinds of affairs. So he gave the Druze some sort of autonomy at a mayoral level. So they're not sovereign anything, but they police their own towns, they solve their own issues, they just have at a very local level. And this has worked. And even after the outbreak of the revolution, March 15, 2011, the Druze walked on the fence. They stayed neutral. Now, granted, many of them were cheering against Assad, were cheering for the success were of the anti-Assad. Hama and Halab were under fire. The Druze went, were shouting in support. They were calling on the world to intervene to help these people who Assad were killing. Now, this is the irony. When the Druze are now on the chopping block, none of the that has been one of my biggest disappointment as someone who supported toppling Assad and the Syrian revolution since day one. And I found it really unsettling that when the Druze went and protested in front of the White House over the weekend and I was there, they're only Druze. Nobody else showed up. And you thought, at least, the other Syrians at least reciprocate toward these people. Now, the new leader in Syria, some of you know him in his with his new name, Ahmad al-Sharaa. His original Al-Qaeda name was Abu Muhammad al-Julani. And of course, you've seen pictures of him as a jihadist Islamist Al-Qaeda guy. And now he changed into modern Western suit with a tie and expensive watches, of course. This change in style just impressed on many capitals that maybe we should give the guy a chance. And I was one of the advocates of really giving him a chance. Back in December, I wrote, well, if the guy says who he says he is, if he is honest about turning the page and forgetting his past, let's give him a chance, which we did. And I think over the past 8 months, what we have seen is more of the same. Once an Islamist, always an Islamist. When President Trump visited the Gulf region in May, I was there in Saudi Arabia. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman asked President Trump to remove sanctions, to meet with Sharjah and remove sanctions. And of course, President Trump was clear. He said, "This is a favor that I'm granting you." And he probably had in mind that one day I'll come back to you with a favor of my own to ask you to ask Saudi Arabia. But for now, the president shook hands with Sharjah and announced that America is going to remove sanctions. Since then, the US envoy to Syria, Tom Barrack, has repeatedly said that the only way to dealing with Syria is to remove sanctions. That if Syria doesn't get the money, the state will collapse, everything will collapse. And to save Syria, we have to give them money. I disagree. And I think that past experiments of giving Islamists money in the hope that they would moderate, it never happened. President Obama tried this with the Iranians. They took the money and they funded their militias. Qatar tried this with Hamas, of course, with a nod from Israel, thinking that if Hamas and Sinwar become busy with money, Israel even gave Gazans tens of thousands of work permits, thinking that, if these guys start having higher incomes, then they'll stop being jihadists. It didn't work. It didn't work in Iran. It didn't work in Gaza in 1979. It didn't work with Khomeini when President Carter and Zbigniew Brzezinski reached out to him and said, "Listen, we have nothing against you. We're against the communists. Just stay with us and everyone will be happy." It didn't work. Khomeini was an Islamist. Iran is still Islamist. Same applies to Hamas. And I think the same will apply to this guy, Sharjah. Now, quickly, just to say what happened over the past week, Sharjah demands that all these components of Syria, the Kurds, the Druze, the Alawites, the Christians, basically the non-Muslims and the non-ethnically Arab, he wants them to bend the knee. He wants to establish his Islamist autocracy, undisputed rule. The Druze can't live this way, and others can't live this way, but especially the Druze, because they at least had a better deal with Assad. So Sharjah went after them in May, in April, in May, and this is the third time, but this one was really planned much better than the ones before. Skirmishes started, presumably between the Arab tribes in the south and their Druze neighbors, and then Sharjah intervened. Now, by intervened, it means that he sent government forces from Damascus. When he sent the government forces, he didn't try to hold back the clans from going into Druze territory. His forces joined the clans in going into Druze territory, forcing the Druze to defend themselves against both sides. The Druze begged Israel, the Druze of Israel lobbied Israel and begged Israel to stop a massacre that was unfolding. Israel listened. They struck some supply lines and some convoys. Shara, therefore, and they also, of course, struck a warning strike inside of Damascus, just a building. No one was targeted, but just a warning to Shara. And Shara did step back, but he was trying to be cunning in that he said, okay, now the government is out of this, but now the tribes want their blood revenge. And now, presumably, the tribes started or mobilizing and organizing and coming after the Druze. The Druze caught a few of these fighters, and now everyone is sure that even though these people were dressed in tribal outfits, their native tribal outfits, everyone is tribal over there, but they all had military identity cards and they all worked for the government. So this was all some act and theater. And once these guys started breaching the Druze line, they killed families wholesale inside their houses. They looted. They burned. Anybody who was walking on the street, they shot them dead. They killed people only because they Druze. They asked them, "Are you Druze or Muslim?" Anyone who couldn't prove that they were Muslim was killed on the spot. So huge atrocities. I think the number now stands at 3,000. They're still counting, but July 16 is definitely what September 11 is to America and what October 7 is to Israel. July 16 is to the Druze of Syria and the Druze of the world.
So, okay, you gave us a lot of things to look at, and so I'm going to ask you to talk about those. I agree with you. You don't give Islamists money, you don't give them whatever. But I also agreed with you when you said we should have given him a chance. It was right to give him a chance in the beginning, and Trump was right. What could we have done, in your opinion, to keep him straighter than he was? Or was it hopeless from the beginning? Do we lay
Well,
out
by
conditions and say you have to meet the conditions? What do we do?
yeah, absolutely. I mean, even the way we designed giving him a chance, we started removing sanctions even before he had given anyone anything. And thankfully, Congress stepped in on Tuesday, and the Financial Services Committee in the House just shut down the idea of giving Shara a clean repeal on the CSIS Sanctions Act. They voted a bipartisan vote, 31-23. Not bipartisan, many Democrats joined the Republicans, but they voted on amending CSIS in such a way that sanctions will be removed if Shara doesn't kill civilians and if Shara respects the rights of minorities. That's how it should be. Trust and verify. It shouldn't be, okay, listen, yeah, we believe you, we like you. We're selling the farm, we're betting the farm on you, and that's that. And after sanctions are removed, then we're begging him not to kill the Druze or the Kurds or the Alawites or anybody else. So I think it should be a trade with him. If he concedes to the Kurds, if he concedes it to the Druze, now at this point, every single decision maker in the government of Damascus is an Islamist who comes from HTS, the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is the organization of Julani, of Shara. At this point, everyone comes, whether it's the justice minister or the security or the intelligence chief, all of these guys. Then you have a layer of ministers, minister of telecom, minister of education, and these are just token people. There are a few of them who are Christian or Druze, but really, I mean, they have no authority. They do not really represent their communities. So what we need Shara to do is to actually concede and share power, whether with the Druze or with the Kurds or the Christians. He would say, like, for example, he would say, listen, the Kurds, okay, you become the defense minister, the actual defense minister. And that should be enough guarantee that if the Kurds lay down their arms, then they have people in power who will make sure that they'll not be massacred like what happened to the Druze. This is not happening. And unfortunately, I'm happy that financial services is now aware of this and not giving Sharia a clean repeal. But unfortunately, some of our allies are just, going all the way, investing him to invest. They're behaving as if there are no sanctions anymore.
Which also accounts, I think, for the anger with Israel over defending the Druze. It's really hard for me to imagine. Yes, I'm an Israel supporter. Okay, let's start there. These people are my neighbors. They're being massacred next door to me, and their cousins are citizens of my country, and not only citizens, but really good citizens, and they serve in my army. What was Israel supposed to do? I mean, I suppose they could have just sat there and said, too bad for you. But is some of the response of, let's say, the French and the British are going crazy. They're going nuts about this. Is it because they don't want to be proven to be wrong? Are they just saying, don't show me that I was wrong? I made a mistake with Al-Shara, and you, Israel, are proving that I was wrong? What are they doing?
Well, first of all, let me just say that Israel's strike was totally the right call. I totally agree, and I think the Druze needed support, and I think without which the Druze might have really lost many, many more lives than they did. Now, the British and the French, listen, the whole Sharia started as a British project when he was the ruler of Idlib. In the north. That's a province in the north on the border with Turkey. Idlib was housing some 4 million Syrians, all the Syrians who had fled the Syrian civil war. And there was a chance that ISIS from the east would overrun Idlib, which would have made things worse. And these 4 million would have probably gone on boats to Europe. Or Assad might have tried to press north. So what the British did was that they groomed Sharia, thinking that he's the least of the many bad options that we had at the time. And that's how Sharia, that's how he they transformed himself. They transformed him from being a Bin Laden copy, a copy of Bin Laden, into the guy in a Western suit that you see now. And I think they're still betting the same way that, listen, this is the best of the worst options that we have. If he goes, we have no alternative. And U.S. Envoy Barrack just said the exact same thing. He said, like, if he goes, we have no alternative. We used to have the same idea about Assad. We always used to say, look, we know that he's killed everyone, but if he goes, we have no alternative. So the point here is that we don't have a plan, even though we pretend that we have one. But the plan is that, okay, just cease fire and let's get the guy who doesn't kill everyone. Let's get the guy who kills probably half the people. So these are the plans that we have.
So wasn't that the plan in Afghanistan? It was time for us to leave, according to President Biden, and the Taliban came in, and not only did they came in and they said, we'll let women go to school, we'll take food aid, we'll be nice to the children, so whatever, right? They did none of it. So don't we learn? Maybe we don't.
Well, Afghanistan has an extra layer of our troops being there. So it was more a more pressing issue than Syria is. Now, in Syria, we don't really have troops. I mean, we have like less than 1,000. They're military advisors helping the Kurds,
Right.
and this was focused on ISIS. But the Syrian civil war, America has never been part of, per se. And if we support the Druze, if we support the Christians of Syria, and if we support the Kurds, this will be really on the cheap for us. Our troops are not involved. We won't be, funding or paying that much of money. It only needs support, diplomatic support, asking the allies to help. I mean, there are so many things we can do short of really invading a country and, getting our hands dirty. So,
I don't want to invade. I don't want to invade any
no,
country. I'm not.
of course. I'm just saying that because, these days, whenever we're discussing foreign policy, people say, oh, you want to invade? No, we're not invading anyone. There's a whole set of things that we can do that doesn't lead to us getting engaged in any shooting or war or invasion or nation building. So we're not doing that. And what we're doing, and this is the irony. The irony is that everyone got angry that Israel violated the sovereignty of Sharia in Syria. The irony is that the reason why Sheta is in this presidential palace is exactly because Israel had violated the sovereignty of Syria and Lebanon in crushing and decapitating Hezbollah, without which Sheta would have been still in Idlib. So at the time, no one seemed to be angry, including Sheta himself. He was probably rooting for Israel to crush Hezbollah, Hezbollah being his enemies. But now, all of a sudden, when Israel comes to the rescue of innocent Druze from being massacred, oh no, the sovereignty, and all of a sudden the sovereignty counts. So I think there's a lot of injustice and unfairness in how we're treating this. Of course, the Europeans were the first to talk about sovereignty, about Syrian sovereignty. So anyway, I think there's a lot to be done short of just giving the country to Islamists and saying, okay, we have throwing our hands in the air and saying we have nothing, no better option and nothing better to do.
So we could create a plan. The United States could, the Western allies could create a plan. And they could present the plan to Shara and discuss it with him and all those sorts of things. But there are some other players that need to be accounted for, right? Because it seems that Shara does not work entirely in a vacuum, not just the Western countries. Talk to us, if you will, about the role of Turkey here, which is right there and meddles in everybody's politics that it can. And Qatar, which meddles in everybody's everything that it can. So talk about them in relation to Syria.
Well, it's these two countries are roughly the same regional power. So they're and they coordinate almost everything that they do, and they support the Muslim Brotherhood and the Sunni Islamists. They are the counterpart of Iran and the Shia Islamists. Now, if you look at Syria, it was dominated by Shia Islamists, Iran and Hezbollah and Assad. And after Israel crushed those, the vacuum that was created was filled by the other Islamists, the ones of Turkey and Qatar. Now, to my mind, any good plan for Syria that we, America, can come up with must keep these three countries out: Iran, Turkey, and Qatar. If we keep these guys out of Syria, and then if we line up our allies, whether it's the UAE, Kuwait, Morocco, Israel, Cyprus, anybody else, all the other guys, everybody else is behaving, and they're good actors. If we line them up behind a plan on how to reconstruct Syria, not only in terms of reconstruction, but also rebuild the state as a state of having, okay, the Druze, you'll get some sort of minister or a block in parliament, the Kurds. So everyone will have a share in this. Of course, Sheta will stay as president forever. No one is trying to throw him out. But we tell Sheta, listen, this is the deal. You will stay president. You get these guys on board with you. You keep the Islamists out, whether Islamist Turkey and Qatar or Iran, and you will get the money, and you will get the support, and you will get recognition. And we will forget that one day you were in Iraq shooting at our troops, and we had to throw you in prison. I mean, we are also conceding to this guy. But if our concession is for a good cause, then it'll be worth it. But just this concession, and then to get all these guys, who are, I mean, if you look at these videos, these people, it's as if they just jumped out of the year 1400. I mean, they literally had axes, and they looked like a mob from 500 years ago, with all the threats, and there are people who were, they're Druze who were killed, their heads severed. So one of the fighters of Shara who was caught, he told about all the instructions that they had received. Their instructions were to kill the Druze. They were not taking any prisoners or hostages, and killing was either shooting or you sever the head. This is barbaric. I mean, this is outside any rules of law or confrontation that we know of in this time and age. So anyway, I was just saying there is a way, there can be a plan. It starts with the US bringing the allies together and keeping the bad actors out.
So I'm stuck between two things here. I can't watch the videos. I don't watch them. It's not possible. But I know what you're saying. I understand what's going on and that people have seen it. So I think two questions. One is, Al-Shaarawy directing this? Are these his people because he wants it, because he lets them know in one way or another that he wants it? That's one question. Number two, if the answer to the first question is yes, how do we talk to him? How do we believe anything he says? I'm fine, President Trump. I get it. I went too far. I'll stop. I'll be nice. I'll bring some Druze in. I'll talk to some Kurds. Why would we believe that would go on for any period of time? Is it possible if one is truly an Islamist and truly believes in Islamist conquest, you're going to give it up? I don't know. So my first question, I think, is the really important one. Is Al-Shaarawy directing this? And if he is, I don't have much hope for the rest of it, much as I'd like to.
Well, that's a great question. And I've been trying hard to answer it to myself first. And the answer would be partially conjecture because, I can't really tell what these guys are talking behind closed doors. But I'll tell you this. Number one, for what we know is that Shara wants to become the undisputed ruler of Syria. Fine. And this means that he might have to suppress the Kurds and the Druze and the Alawites. Okay. But even if he does that, he will not become the undisputed ruler of Syria because the biggest militia and the most potent of the militias that threatens Shara's grip himself is the Turkey militia called the Syrian National Army. And this is under a guy whose name is Muhammad Jassim and goes by the nom de guerre Abu Amshi. He's a very obnoxious, brutal guy, very bloody. During the attack on the Alawites of the coast 4 months ago, he won his fame for being really notorious. Abu Amshi doesn't take orders, even though he's officially the commander, I think, of the 52nd or 62nd division of the Syrian army, placed they're stationed in Hama in the center in central Syria. Even though he's officially part of the military, but in reality he's not. He's with the Turkish intelligence. He takes his orders from Turkey. And a few months back, without Shara being involved in it, he tried to take on the Kurds and the Kurds beat him. And he had to retreat. So now this is the question. How much Abu Amshi is doing this out of his, own volition? How much of it is coming from Turkey? Is he really taking orders from Shara? I don't think he is. I think 70% of what you saw of the attack on the Druze, the order came from Turkey. I think Turkey is trying to find itself a foothold on the border with Israel. I think the major driver of what's going on in Syria right now is competition between Turkey and Israel. And one of the people in this town who was working on Syria, and he knows this really well, he was working hard on de-escalating. Now, this policy is not in place anymore, but after Mr. Barak took over. But de-escalation between Israel and Turkey was our number one priority before Shara came on board and we shook hands with him. So this guy, Abu Amshi, I think if Shara steps out of order, Abu Amshi might take him out. So now here's the thing. How much of what Shara is doing is Shara's idea and free will? How much of it is that he's triangulating between, Turkey and himself and Abu Amshi? I can't really answer these questions, but what I know is that this attack on the Druze was led by two main clans, and these clans are from the northeast of Syria on the border with Iraq. So these tribes are both Iraqi and Syrian. The number one tribe, they call the Agedat. And Agedat, these guys, two of Agedat are top HTS, and now they're in the government of Syria. Sayyid Salama, who's the intelligence chief, he's from Agedat. And Yusuf al-Hajar, who's in the foreign ministry, and he's, one of the senior political figures in HTS, is also from Agedat. These guys recruited their clan and sent it south, 350 miles, mind you. It's not like a short distance. So it needs a lot of organization and busing and networking and logistics, moving all the fighters and the ammunition. And then the second tribe is the tribe of this Turkish guy, not Turkish, but the Syrian guy who works for Turkey, Abu Amshi, and he's from the Naim clan. And it's close to Agadez on the border with Iraq. And Abu Amshi got the Naim. So you have these two clans. They were the major fighting force that went after the Druze. And mind you, these clans are not connected by any way to the clans of the south who are supposed to be having the blood revenge with the Druze. And in the tribal code, it doesn't work this way. You know, when you go and fight with another clan, you have to have a claim, you have to have blood connection. And the blood connection was not there. So this was, they made it look as if it was clan and tribal revenge. But we know that Shadar's intelligence and Turkey's guy were the ones who were calling the shots and who were planning everything all along.
So that leaves us with other problems. I mean, it's not like we don't have enough problems here, but that's another one because the administration, the American administration, does prize its relations with Turkey, always has, also with Qatar, but thinks of Turkey as an important ally, a NATO ally. And it's not clear what the administration would be willing to do to tell Turkey to back off. It may, I mean, I'll ask this as a question. Is it possible for an administration to say to al-Shara, this is what we have in mind for you, this is what we want for you, this is what we want for Syria, and we'll help you get it, and at the same time not tell Turkey back off? And if we tell Turkey to back off, who says they will? So are we putting ourselves, as Americans, are we putting ourselves in an awkward position between the ally we think we have, which is Turkey, and the, I don't want to call him an ally, but the guy we'd like to work with in Syria? Does he have to get rid of those pro-Turkish people in his administration? Does he have to, what does he have to do to make us comfortable?
First of all, let me say that I'm not the Turkey expert, but Turkey and Qatar, every step they're doing undermines every interest we have in the Middle East, our interests and the interests of our allies. There's not a single policy or step or action that they do that serves the national interests of the United States or of any one of its allies in that part of the world. Now, this said, if I talk to these, if I were the US government and I talk to either government, Turkey or Qatar, my first message would be, cut it out. Stop the double face, you know? Al Jazeera is just instigating against the West, America, Jews, Israel, everyone. And Erdogan does the same. But then they talk to us and they pretend that we're allies. And what we want to stop is that we are watching you. You know, we are listening to your channels and to your speeches. There's no separation between these two. You can't tell your people that we hate America and then come and ask us to sell you F-35 or pretend that you're our ally or that, you know, some other whatever connection that we have or our partner. The same applies to Qatar. And, you know, this hypocrisy has to stop. Otherwise, I mean, there's no way any two allies can work, you know, the way that Qatar and Turkey are. I mean, if Turkey was not a member of NATO and Qatar was not, as President Biden announced them, a major non-NATO ally, if these countries did not have this status, I'd be advocating for placing sanctions on these two nations, just going to full confrontation with them, just the way we're doing with Iran, because they're really undermining what we're doing at every corner. It's unfortunate that I don't think we've had an honest conversation with the rulers of either one of these governments.
So that doesn't make me very optimistic because I'm watching Qatar's position vis-a-vis Hamas in the Gaza Strip. And it's not clear to me why we continue to use them as an interlocutor. The president had made clear his interest in getting the hostages back. They're talking now about Hamas's demand that the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation leave Gaza, and that Hamas and UNRWA remain in charge of the food. Where do they get the right to make this demand? Why does Qatar bring this to the United States? They ought to know that that's not going to be our position, but they do it anyway. So our experience, my experience watching the US government doing negotiations of a sort with Hamas and Qatar, is that Qatar doesn't really care what we think anyway. And I find that problematic. So it doesn't, in my view, bode well for what will happen in Syria. Maybe they think they're rich enough that they don't have to care. Don't know.
So if you're Israel or the US and you look at the region, you will find that you have two major blocs, the Shia Islamism of Iran and the Sunni Islamism of Turkey and Qatar. But then there's a third bloc, the Arab bloc, which has really been opposed to Islamism. They're Sunnis, but they're opposed to Islamism either way, Shia Islamism and Sunni Islamism. I mean, to me, it's been a disappointment that Saudi Arabia is not punching its weight. It's supposed to be the one that fills the gap. When Iran collapses in Syria, instead of Turkey filling the gap, I would have loved to see Saudi Arabia do that. Now, unfortunately, they're not doing it. I don't know whether this is intentional or, beyond their abilities to do so. Of course, I think the Emiratis are doing a great job, but they can't do it alone. I mean, they need the whole bloc has to act together. So this Arab Gulf bloc has to act together. Now, of course, a bigger disappointment has been Egypt and Jordan. I mean, these guys are just non-existent. And when they speak, they just take the side of Hamas, even against Palestinian moderates. I mean, Egypt and Jordan, things have been going crazy with them since October 7. But the whole idea, the whole design under Biden and now under Trump was to have the Gulf bloc punch its way, just show its way, just step up with Israel and the US, fix Syria and Lebanon, and keep the troublemaking guys, Turkey, Qatar, and Iran out of this. Now, unfortunately, this is not happening. I can't really explain why. There are, dozens of reasons why it's not happening. But the end result is that we're getting rid of Shia Islam and re replacing it with Sunni Islam. And I think the outcome will be as bad.
I asked that question. Did we replace in Syria the Iranians with Sunni Islamic fundamentalism? Maybe we did, and maybe it goes back to what we said in the beginning, which is that what the West considers the best form of government, which is a central government for all of the people who live in the borders, maybe that's not the way it goes. Certainly it doesn't go that way in Syria. Doesn't seem to be that going that way in Lebanon. I understand that Hezbollah told the Lebanese government, it was going to now not give up any more of its weapons. It's just decided it's done enough. I don't know if that's true. I suspect it could be. But maybe we're just misreading the situation and we're expecting different things than we're going to get from people in the region.
Well,
Maybe.
look, I think it's unfortunate that until now, the only rule in the region is that might makes right.
Absolutely.
And that's the worst possible rule, but that's what it is. And what we need to happen is to get some sort of a more, updated rule, so to speak, updated to be nice. And this updated rule, I mean, I'd wish it could have been liberal democracy. But I mean, there's no Thomas Jefferson. So I don't think this is happening. So we have to deal with what we have. And as we deal with what we have to be consistent. So if these people of the region think that self-determination is a thing for everyone, for the Saudis, the Syrians, the Palestinians, Lebanese, then they have to take into consideration that the Druze have the right to self-determination, that the Kurds also have the right to self-determination. If self-determination is the thing, then you have to ask everyone whether they want to be part of this European drone border, the Sykes-Picot border, or if you don't, just be my guest. You have your country, I have my country, we'll be good neighbors. The point here is that there's no consistency. So sometimes everyone is shouting for self-determination, and then when the Druze want a state, everyone is against self-determination, and this is it's the irony is that envoy Barak, he started off by saying Sykes-Picot borders were bad, and he thought, okay, well, that's interesting. We haven't said this before. But then a few days after that, he was talking about why the unity of Syria is really important. And I was thinking, but you were saying that the borders are not engraved in stone. So even within one administration, within one span of a few months, we're inconsistent and they're inconsistent and everyone is inconsistent. And as long as this is the situation, you can't really have a conversation over international law. And I mean, it's really amazing that all the cries about Gaza and genocide, and no one cared about 2,000 or 3,000 Druze killed in 3 days. So again, consistency. Are we being humanitarian? Are we being realistic? Are we, and this is one of the things that annoy me the most about this region, as someone who's been doing this for 30 years and arguing and debating, is each one would just say whatever makes them feel good or whatever serves their interest. And of course, ideas be damned.
Okay, that was a question I was going to ask you about why the international community gets so excited about Palestinian self-determination and a Palestinian state, but not about Druze and not about Kurds. Kurds are the avatar here. They've tried for so long to do it, and the best they've got is in Iraq. They have North Kurdistan, and theoretically it's part of Iraq, but it's a little less part of Iraq. Self-determination, I think, is not what the West sees for the Middle East. But how about those Hebron clans who said, we'd like to establish, and we talked about this last week with Harold Road, we would like to establish in Hebron an emirate of Hebron, that this is our space. I think there are about 700,000 people that they consider in all of the clans of Hebron. And that's a substantial group of people. And the Hebron Emirate would make peace with Israel. That's it. I do this, you do that, we have peace between us. And the Palestinian Authority would have nothing to say about it. The Palestinian Authority, of course, had a lot to say about it as soon as they made the announcement. But maybe devolving into areas of autonomy is not a bad idea. I don't know. I mean, it seems to me that what we've you're quite right. We haven't figured it out yet. I was intrigued by the Emirates. I mean, the United Arab Emirates is a group of Emirates. That's what it is. Why not a Hebron Emirate? Why not a Gaza Emirate? Except that there are clans and tribes in Gaza. Maybe we need a whole different vision for this that doesn't consist of borders that were drawn by colonial powers. 100 years ago, starting after World War I. Maybe we're just behind the times here.
No, I think I agree with most of what you said.
Tell me the
I think
parts
it
you don't agree with. I want to know which parts you don't agree with.
no, actually all of it. I mean, just yeah, but just to leave space for, if I didn't catch something. But no, I mean, yeah, of course. I think that the nation state has not been understood or internalized among Arabic-speaking populations in the region. And we forced it on them, the world forced it on them, and this is the result. The reason why the Gulf is in a much better situation compared to Syria and Lebanon and Iraq or to North Africa is because the Gulf was somehow isolated from European ideas and whatever the world imposed on them and borders. And the Gulf got to evolve organically on its own. Whether they have the tribal system of you pledge allegiance to someone and it works. It works somehow. It works. And look, I mean, look at them. It's working brilliantly for them. So I'm not saying that this is the best system in the work in the world, but this system is definitely the best in the region and it works for these guys. Now, to go back to the Levant and Syria and Lebanon. Number one, the borders were drawn in a way that put the Kurds with the Arabs, and for no obvious reason. I mean, why do we have to have the Kurds? We talked about Assad with the Druze. We didn't talk about Assad, Papa Assad, with the Kurds, because he was with the Ba'ath Party. He changed the names of villages. He wouldn't give the Kurds identity cards. He wouldn't let them call their kids Kurdish names. Now, mind you, after Shara took over, A few things that he refused to change. Number one, many called on Sharaq to drop the name Arab from the official name of Syria. So Syria's official name is the Syrian Arab Republic. And after Assad, everyone said, listen, we're not all Arabs. We're Kurds and Turkmen and Assyrian and this and that. So let's just keep it Syria or the Syrian Republic. And they wouldn't drop Arab. So this is number one. This is the new Syria, by the way. So new Syria is one that really doesn't represent 2 million Kurds. Number two, there were two articles in the old Syrian constitution that were kept in the new one. One stipulates that the president must be Muslim, and this leaves 35% of Syrians from becoming president because they're non-Muslim, really. And number two, it says that the legislation that Islam is a major source of legislation in Syria. Again, you leave 35% of the population out of this. This is not how nation states work. You cannot have, something that's Arab and projected in everyone without giving anyone the right to behave as a minority. If you look at the Israeli example, the country was designed along the lines of Judaic Hebraic heritage. But the Druze are recognized as full citizens and called a minority because clearly their flag, the five colored flag, is not the national flag. But it works, There's nothing similar on the Syrian side or on the Lebanese side and the Iraqi side. Now, the last thing I want to say about sovereignty. Sovereignty is usually given. I mean, if you're outside, there are four or five countries in the world, US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and someone else, who are considered multi-ethnic, wherein you are a citizen if you pledge allegiance to this document, this constitution that was drafted by our founding fathers. Most other countries in the world, whether Denmark or France or Israel, it's mono-ethnic and it's based on one ethnic group with a specific heritage and language and history. So if you take this back to Israel, now Israel is defined just like France or Denmark or the state of the Jewish people. If you try to apply this to other populations, to Palestinians, for example, there's nothing specific particular about Palestinians that's not also shared with other Arabs. So if you're a Palestinian or Syrian or Lebanese and you're Sunni Muslim, you have the exact same heritage, whether it's food or religion or language or music or history or you name it. So what makes it so particular for the Palestinians to get sovereignty as a Palestinian sovereign state? That set them apart from the Syrians, really nothing. So now this is the point. But if you're Druze, Syrian, you will need it because you're not Sunni, you're not Muslim. The same applies to Kurds. You're not Arab. You're ethnically different. You have your own language. So these questions are not are never debated. And of course, we as as the United States, I mean, it's not our job to tell people who they are. But I mean, you probably could help with the debate, like tell them, okay, guys, let's come up with one major plan for everyone, a master plan. This means sovereignty. This means you get this. This means you can redraw your border. Because as it stands, there's no common reference. Each one on their side, whether in Syria or in Israel or Saudi Arabia, each one is just debating the way they see fit. There are some people who want to invade everyone and turn them to Islam. And then there are others who live in the UAE who think we're all human and let's focus on AI. So there are really no common points of reference, which I'd love, the West and the US to try to help these people to think, to internalize these concepts, to come up with a new master plan for everyone.
But I would say too, and this is the reason I laughed when you were talking. I was certainly not laughing at you, but that's, we can't make them. We can offer them, we can suggest to them, we can bribe them, whatever you want, but you can't make them do those things. And
Absolutely.
I think that's where, at the bottom line, that's what I think the Western problem is. We tell them to. We tell them, have a vote. You have to elect a president. You have to do this. You have to do that. And I think you're totally right that we could engage them. And probably are a lot of people that would engage. You got to worry about the people with the, with the guns and the axes, but we can't tell them. And this is not where I thought this conversation was going to go, Hussein, but I'm glad that it went there. because it points out some of the shortcomings of US foreign policy. It is not a criticism of the Trump administration or the Biden administration or anybody else's administration. It's a criticism of how we look at things because it's not how we do things. So I think I'm going to stop there because it's been extremely useful for me anyway, and I think for our listeners to stop thinking about the Middle East or Africa, by the way, and all of these same issues occur in Africa, and they occur in between India and Pakistan and Bangladesh. There have been those. It's out there, and it's for us to think about what we want from our government when our government approaches other countries, what we think would make the most sense, not just because we're Americans, they have to do. So I'm going to stop there and ponder this, but I have to go with one more thought because, as I say, thank you for a truly enlightening hour. As I said, it's not where I thought we were going, but I think it's probably where we should have gone. People who listen periodically know that I like to end on an optimistic note. We haven't had many of those in this conversation. Can you give us an optimistic thought with which to conclude the program? And even if you can't, let me say thank you again. This was terrific. I appreciate it, and I hope you'll come back. Now, can you give us an optimistic thought?
Well, after this week, it's really hard, but let me try. I think Israel did an amazing job and reached that reshuffled the Middle East, and that gives everyone an opportunity, a window to change to the better. And my hope is that these people really grasp the opportunity. And my hope is that with our guidance as in America, we help these people grasp the opportunity. So let's leave it there, because if I talk more, it might turn into pessimism.
I don't know. I like it. It's a window. A
It's
window.
a window.
A window. The window's a good thing. Hussein Abdul Hussein, FDD is lucky to have you. And thank
Thank
you
you.
again for coming and joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Shoshana.